Freya, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting heavy fighting breaks out in eastern Ukraine. A major battle flared Wednesday outside a main separatist stronghold in eastern Ukraine, leaving more than a dozen dead, threatening to push the country back into civil war. Ukrainian officials say the fighting broke out near Donetsk when about 1,000 pro-Russian rebel fighters, backed by artillery and tanks, launched a pre-dawn attack west of the city. Marie Harf is a U.S. spokesperson.
These attacks by combined Russian separatist forces are on the Ukrainian side of the ceasefire line. They have reportedly utilized Grad rockets and other heavy weapons that should have been withdrawn under the February Minsk plan, and they've reportedly killed at least one and injured 20 Ukrainians. Any new attack or aggressive action by combined Russian separatist forces is unacceptable and contravenes the Minsk agreements. Russia bears direct responsibility for preventing these attacks and implementing a ceasefire. Any attempts to seize additional Ukrainian territory will be met with increased costs.
A ceasefire reached in Minsk in February required both sides to withdraw heavy weapons from the line of contact, but international observers say those provisions have been violated. Yet another blast rocked the northern Nigerian city Maiduguri Wednesday, killing at least six. The blast struck near an army barracks, just to the latest bombing to rock the Borno state capital in recent days. The Islamist insurgent group Boko Haram is suspected. Speaking in Niamey Wednesday, capital of Niger, on his first foreign trip since becoming president, Muhammadu Buhari pledged to defeat the Islamist group. Mr. Buhari says he'll chase the group from its last trenches. 5 years of the evil presence, he says, is enough. The Nigerian leaders visiting both Niger and Chad, two or three countries that have joined Abuja in launching a joint offensive in February that has pushed Boko Haram out of much of the territory it's occupied. This is VOA News. A senior U.S. official says the military operation aimed at degrading and destroying the Islamic State has killed more than 10,000 militant fighters in less than a year. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke in France in a radio a day after he and other officials from partner countries met in Paris with Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to discuss their strategy to fight the IS group. Josh Earnest is a White House spokesman.
There are thousands of ISIL fighters that have been taken off the battlefield due to the combined impact of our coalition military airstrikes as well as the efforts of Iraqi and Kurdish security forces on the ground. And this is indicative of the kind of strategy that we see ISIL often use to essentially sacrifice significant numbers of foot soldiers, as they did around their failed attempt to take and hold Kobani, which we assess led to the death of at least 1,000 ISIL fighters in that one Syrian town.
However, he warned the militant group is recruiting internationally to replenish its forces. Visiting Qatar Wednesday, U.S. envoy for the anti-IS campaign, retired Marine General John Allen said setbacks last month in Iraq's western Anbar province redoubled American determination to fight the militant group. He warned the fight against IS will likely take a generation or more. The U.N. envoy to Libya warned representatives of the rival governments meeting in Algiers on Wednesday the North African country is at the limit and risks becoming a failed state. Bernardino Leon, hosting the latest round of unity talks, called on both sides to stop seeking new concessions from the other and forge a united front against the Islamic State, which has established a presence in Libya. He also warned the country will be unable to pay salaries in about 6 weeks' time. Israeli jets struck Hamas military training sites in Gaza early Thursday in response to rocket fire against Israel a day earlier. A radical Islamist Salafist group that backs the IS group claimed responsibility for Wednesday's rocket attack. It said it was out to avenge the killing of one of its members by Hamas. A nearly two-month-long war between Israel and Hamas last year killed more than 2,000 Palestinian civilians and obliterated entire neighborhoods. Experts at the U.S. Central Bank say the U.S. economy started growing again in the second quarter after contracting in the first few months of the year. In its business survey, the Federal Reserve found that manufacturing improved in most areas except for the energy industry, where falling oil prices have hurt investment. A separate report shows the service sector of the economy displayed continued growth, but at a slower pace than previously thought. A different study shows the trade picture improving with fewer imports and more exports. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Ebony Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 4th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's military denies Amnesty International report of human rights violations.
It's indeed unfortunate that the organization just went out, gathered names of specific officers in a calculated attempt to rubbish their reputation as well as the image of the Nigerian military.
Major General Chris Olukolade is a spokesman for Nigeria's military. There are allegations Khartoum is supplying arms to South Sudan rebels. Researchers say some well-known common drugs may be the key to curing Ebola, and Burundi's opposition and civil society groups welcome postponement of this Friday's parliamentary election.
Most of the people on the ground opposition and those protesters are happy with that, even if they didn't talk about the question of third mandate and many other questions.
Innocent Muhoozi is the general manager of Burundi's independent Renaissance radio and television network. Some West Africa Ebola workers get psychosocial support, and Egypt's security is under siege with near daily attacks. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and Our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for Nigeria's military says accusations by Amnesty International of human rights violations are an unfortunate effort aimed at undermining the army's resolve to defeat the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. In a report released Wednesday, Amnesty said Nigerian soldiers and militia have murdered, tortured, and abused thousands of detainees since March 2011. But Army spokesman Major General Chris Olukolade tells reporter Peter Clarty the military will not be deterred in its determination to raid the country of Boko Haram.
Indeed, it's an unfortunate allegation, considering all the efforts that have been made here to ensure that human rights are strictly observed in all our operations, and also the desperation with which that report appear to have been targeted at blackmailing the Nigerian military and specific officers. The officers mentioned in that report have no reason whatsoever to indulge in the allegations that have been made against them. It is indeed unfortunate that the organization just went out, gathered names of specific officers in a calculated attempt to rubbish their reputation as well as the image of the Nigerian military. The action, no doubt, depicts more of a premeditated indictment aimed at discrediting the country for whatever purpose, which we don't know at this moment. Each of the previous allegations had been thoroughly responded to and cleared in the public as well as officially.
Will the Nigerian military officially petition this organization to register your protest?
We're definitely considering additional actions to respond to this unfortunate trend. Somehow, Amnesty International has become more active in presenting destructive allegations whenever the terrorists are losing ground in the battle in Nigeria. It's very unfortunate that Amnesty International has again used that method in this report to further confirm the fact that we believe they have been playing questionable roles in our counter-terrorism effort in Nigeria. We will definitely not take this line low, more so as they did not even give us the opportunity to clarify some of this. And in the ones we clarified, they still insisted, still erroneously, to keep presenting it to the world with a view to, you know, rubbing their blackmail.
Did the military investigate some of these allegations and clear some of these officials that have been mentioned in this report?
In the first place, these allegations were never properly presented. We have a posture which we have made clear to not just Amnesty International, but everybody. And the posture is that this armed forces of Nigeria does not tolerate or encourage the abuse of human rights. It will not condone it on the part of any of its personnel. Anyone who acts is answerable for his actions. And if any is well proved, definitely will take action against it. Unfortunately, they have never been proved beyond gathering the reports of either some collaborators, some sympathizers, and even particularly terrorists in some occasions. But each time we have cause to punish anybody, we will not hesitate to do that. But it's unfortunate to keep insisting on what we know has not been proved.
Major General Chris Olukolade is the spokesman for Nigeria's military. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The Ebola virus, which ravaged West Africa and terrorized the world this past year, is largely under control. But if history is any guard, any outbreak is almost certain to happen again. Next time, though, healthcare workers will likely be better prepared to combat the deadly disease and protect themselves. In fact, researchers have discovered that some common drugs may shield those who are exposed to the virus from being infected. VOA's Jessica Burma reports.
Ebola is highly contagious, with a fatality rate of up to 90%. Doctors and nurses who tended to the sick and many patients' family members contracted the virus from contact with infected body fluids. As the virus spread unchecked, researchers raced to develop vaccines and treatments, most of which are still in the experimental phase. But now some well-known compounds, drugs long since approved for use against other disorders, may get new life for their ability to repel Ebola. A widely prescribed antidepressant, commonly known as Zoloft, and Vascor, a drug used to treat high blood pressure, were found to block the spread of the virus in a study of mice, and researchers say they potentially could protect people exposed to Ebola. Gene Olinger, a researcher with the U.S. National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in Frederick, Maryland, says the drugs contain a small molecule compound that works in two ways.
They're actually directly blocking the virus, either by blocking a critical cell component, actually our cells have, that it needs to live, or it actually blocks the virus from getting in.
Vascor protected 100% of mice against infection with Ebola, and Zoloft was 70% effective, according to a study in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Olinger was part of a research team that screened 2,600 drugs already approved by regulatory authorities and found 30 agents, including antihistamines, that block the virus to some degree. Because the drugs are already known to be safe, Olinger says they could be rolled out quickly in an Ebola epidemic. The approval process for new drugs, he adds, could take years.
To do that requires at least 10 years, sometimes 15 years of clinical development, and requires about $1 billion. That's what the industry standard is. And so for these emerging pathogens, that's a long time to wait for an answer. So this is the opportunity to use what we have.
Zoloft and Vascor would likely be prescribed off-label in an Ebola emergency, meaning they would be used against the virus even though regulators had approved them for different diseases. That practice is common among doctors when they believe off-label use may relieve patient suffering. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Some Ebola workers and survivors in West Africa are in need of psychosocial support resources, which are already hard to find in Ebola-affected countries. Louise Joel Hansen is a spokesperson for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's Reference Center for Psychosocial Support. She tells Ricky Stryak that some support is already being offered to burial teams in the Ebola-affected countries.
They are doing activities for the Red Cross, Red Crescent, mainly Red Cross in those countries. For the volunteers who are working in the Ebola situation, especially for the volunteers who are doing safe and dignified burials, because this is very, very difficult work. It's dangerous and they are experiencing a lot of stigmatization. The national societies in Guinea and Liberia and Sierra Leone. It's not a psychological debriefing like you would sometimes see in Western situations, where you have this structured way of going through exactly what happened and in quite a lot of details. We don't recommend that.
Why not, may I ask?
What it boils down to is that this is something that has been done for a lot of years, and newer research has shown that it's not the best way of doing it, and in some cases it may actually be harmful.
Someone else from the Red Cross mentioned to me a specific example of a burial worker who was having very bad nightmares. They eventually actually went to a traditional healer in the area, and they were very skeptical at first, but the nightmares went away afterwards. Are there any of these traditional methods being used or being recommended? How is the Red Cross working with traditional medicine and traditional healing in these areas?
I can't give you specifics on how exactly they're working with the traditional healers, but When we talk about psychosocial support, it's very, very important for us to underscore the of taking in local customs. You can't come in with a Western concept of this is how we're going to do it, this is trauma, this is psychiatric diagnosis, so this is how we're going to do it. You have to go in and see how does the local culture look at these things, what are the coping mechanisms that's already in the society and work with those, because otherwise you're going to set yourself up for a big fail and you're not going to help people.
What are the risks of not treating trauma?
We know that in populations that have experienced trauma or disasters, we have a higher prevalence of mental health problems. That we know.
How does it impact society?
If a lot of people are suffering and are not getting any help, then it will impact the way that your local community is working. Your kids' friends may not be doing well in school. There may be problems in school, which will impact your kid. Your co-workers may not be coping very well. That will impact you. So that's on the more personal level. On the more societal level, you will have people who are feeling bad and who may be reacting in ways that are not very good for themselves and for their families and for society. And it will impact on a more community level.
Louise Jewel Hansen is the spokesperson for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's Reference Center for Psychosocial Support. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Copenhagen. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Thursday, June 4th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Burundi's opposition parties and civil society groups say they welcome Wednesday's announcement by the government to postpone this Friday's parliamentary election, but they maintain that President Pierre Nkurunziza's contentious decision to seek a third term, which has sparked weeks of violent protest, is non-negotiable. Innocent Muhozi, general manager of the Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network, says Nkurunziza's third-term bid is one of many issues the opposition and organizers of the protest want to highlight during the next round of talks, which the opposition agreed to resume with the government.
Globally, it's a positive reaction because people clearly saw that it was not possible to have elections in such kind of conditions. Most of the people on the ground, the opposition and those protesters, are happy with that, even if they didn't talk about the question of third mandate and many other questions. But as the communique said, it's possible that this postponement will help to deal with all the other questions that are on the table now.
The reason the protesters are in the street every day is because President Nkurunziza decided he's going to seek a third term. And the East African leaders did not address that. Is the opposition hoping that this issue can still be addressed?
This question will be one of the questions on the table during the talks, for sure. And then next, I think people must understand that all these reactions of people protesting against this third term for President Nkurunziza is just a symbol of a system that has been killing people, has been torturing people, that have been almost destroying the economy of the country. So when people are fighting against this third mandate, mostly it's much more about the way the system worked during those 10 years than specifically against Mr. Nkurunziza himself.
If the opposition says they are ready to resume talks with the government, what are they going to be talking about?
A lot of questions. This third term question, for example, the basic human rights, the right to protest peacefully, the right to have access to information. As you know, independent media has been destroyed, and now today the owners can even not access to their own places. This question of extrajudicial execution, political leaders in opposition, in exile, the brutality of the security services, and so there are many questions that will be for sure on the table, including this one about militias.
Innocent, tell me, the Electoral Commission is supposed to consider when this parliamentary election will be held again. In the meantime, how legal is this Electoral Commission? Because we hear that some members have left or some of them have run away. Is this commission legally constituted?
No, it's not anymore legally constituted because there were supposed to be 5 persons in this commission. And the way they have to take decision is supposed to be 3 on 4. Today, it cannot work anymore. So the first question to be addressed is to rebuild another independent commission that will be able to decide decide about this or that. Now,
in the meantime, do we know if the presidential election is still set for June 26?
They didn't talk about that. They just said that they postponed. The president of this electoral commission this evening announced that they decided to postpone the elections, but to say that they cannot tell when they will be, and that we have to wait to the right people to take the right decision. This means the president of the republic through a decree.
Innocent Muhozi is the general manager of the Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. A British-based small arms research group says despite repeated denials by Khartoum, the SPLM in opposition, it has strong evidence Sudan has been supplying weapons to the South Sudanese rebels. In a report released Wednesday, the group Conflict Armament Research says its investigators analyzed ammunition and guns used by the rebels in Jonglei and United States and found the weapons came from Khartoum. Charlton Doki of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
Claudio Gramizi, the lead investigator at Conflict Armament Research, says the ammunition and weapons were airdropped by Sudanese planes to rebel fighters in Upper Nile and Jonglei states on several occasions from September to December of last year.
I think we can fairly surely confirm the fact that this equipment was airdropped. This comes not only from the reports of the FPLA officers that worked with us, but also from the fact that most of the equipment was somehow deformed or bent, probably due to the impact at the moment of the landing.
Gramizi says the ammunition his group analyzed appears to have been manufactured in Sudan. He says the head stamp codes and marking codes on the ammunition were identical with Sudanese manufactured ammunition analyzed earlier.
This is quite interesting, not only because they are Sudanese manufactured, which by itself may not be a big indication of the chain of custody and the origin of these equipment, but the fact that many of them were actually manufactured in 2014. So the same year they were used by the rebels, which to us is an indication of the fact that the chain of custody had to be very short and therefore probably suggesting a direct origin from Sudan.
Dickson Gatluak, a military spokesman for the SPLA in opposition, denies his group receives any support from Khartoum.
We have even been accusing by the Juba regime that we are getting support, military support from Khartoum. And these are baseless. If you look at it, these are the unfounded stories. We are using the enemy as a source of our ammunition.
Gatluak says the rebels get their arsenal and ammunition from defeated government forces or those who choose to join. The group says some of the ammunition it analyzed was manufactured in China in 2011 and 2012. And Gramizi says Chinese manufactured ammunition captured from the rebels in Jonglei state is identical to the ammunition used by rebels during what the UN labeled a massacre that occurred at a mosque in Bentiu in April of last year. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Gunmen on a motorbike shot and killed two policemen Wednesday near Egypt's iconic pyramids. The attack came a day after a hearing to confirm death sentences against top Muslim Brotherhood leaders was postponed by a Cairo court. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
The shooting took place in broad daylight in an area teeming with activity near Egypt's iconic Grand Pyramids in Giza. Witnesses say three assailants opened fire on members of Egypt's tourist police, killing one instantly. A second officer died at a local hospital. The gunmen fled on their motorbike. Islamic militants and opponents of the Egyptian government have been waging a low-level street war against members of the police and military since Islamist President Mohamed Morsi was toppled in July 2013 by the army following large street protests against him. Most of the violence against government targets has taken place in Egypt's northern Sinai region, where militants have attacked police and army compounds, checkpoints, and military convoys, killing dozens. Sporadic attacks on police and army targets in Cairo and elsewhere have also prompted tighter security and more arrests of suspected militants. Tuesday, an Egyptian court postponed a decision on whether to uphold death sentences against top Muslim Brotherhood leaders in several high-profile cases. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is on a state visit to Germany, where Mr. Sisi said Egypt's judiciary followed international norms and many of those sentenced to death were tried in absentia and would be retried if arrested. He also defended the ouster of Mr. Morsi. He says that on the day of Mr. Morsi's ouster, a statement was issued which did not hurt or harm a single Egyptian, and the chance was given to everyone to participate in a new political process, and we never imagined entering into violence against each other for several years. Calls for violence against the Egyptian government, military, police, and judiciary have been frequent on Facebook, Twitter, and various Islamist-leaning satellite channels in the months since Mr. Morsi was ousted. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Oma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Tournament debutants Senegal drew 1-1 with Colombia to secure their first point at the men's FIFA Under-20 World Cup in Hamilton, New Zealand on Wednesday, while Mali lost 2-0 to Serbia in Dunedin. Today, Thursday, Nigeria encountered North Korea in a must-win encounter in New Plymouth. Nigeria lost 4-2 to Brazil in their opening tie. Elsewhere, Niger host Gabon in a friendly in Niamey on Saturday as part of their build-up to the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers due next week. Andorra welcome Equatorial Guinea while Burkina Faso play Cameroon as Guinea face Chad. On Sunday, Mali play Libya in Casablanca, Morocco as Ghana welcome Togo in Accra. And next Monday, Egypt host Mali in Bogo El Arabi. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, commits to supporting the consolidation of FIFA that will be acceptable to all, the continental body stated in Cairo on Wednesday. In the wake of FIFA President Sepp Blatter's decision to step down, CAF assures that they will cooperate in safeguarding the moral and ethical values that underpin football both on and off the playing field. Turning to athletics, sprinter Kabange Mupopo of Zambia and Kenya's Kevin Nkanata seek to make an impact in women's 400 meters and men's 200 meters respectively at the IAAF Diamond League in the Italian capital Rome today, Thursday. Botswana's Olympic silver medalist Nigel Amos and Ethiopian world champion Mohamed Aman go head-to-head in men's 800 meters. Ethiopian Hagos Gebrehiwet and Yomif Kejelecha face Kenyan Olympic bronze medalist Thomas Longisiwa in men's 5,000 meters. On the infield, Egyptian Africa record holder Ihab Abdelrahman El Sayed, Kenyan Julius Yego, and South African Rocco van Rooyen spearhead the African charge for victory. Back on the track, Ethiopian Dawit Seyaoum and Aksumawit Mbaye, along with Morocco's Rababi Arafi, contest women's 1500 meters. Kenya's Lydia Chepkurui and Hivin Kiyang face Ethiopia's Sofia Assefa and Hiwot Aileo in women's 3000 meters. Steeplechase. Algerian Amina Betis and Moroccan Salima El Ouali Alami seek to end the East African dominance of the event. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Oman in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has announced an independent panel to investigate the UN's handling of reports of child sex abuse by French soldiers in the Central African Republic. A statement from Ban's office Wednesday said the secretary wants to ensure the UN does not fail the victims of sex abuse. That's it for this Thursday, June 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that all of you in Africa will have a very good Thursday.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. On Saturdays, tune in at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC. And on Sundays at 5:30 and 17:30 UTC. or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA. That's Encounter on VOA Africa.